he began to recall the elf from death, for he was a priest of great powers, and sought to share his abilities with all in need. He was halted by the elf's wife, and when he asked her why, she said, "It is not our way. He is now in a far better place, and should you recall him, he will not return, but against his will, and to our sorrow. That is why we will not speak his name, lest he hear longing in our voices and return to comfort us at cost of his own. From what I know, no elf has ever been recalled from death. I have been told by some that no elf can be revived by human arts. Others have said that elves have no true souls, which is why they do not return. I think both are false, and they have a finer sense of where they live in the world." Garrett was quiet for a moment while he digested this information.
"It is a strange tale, Huntmaster. What brought it to mind?"
"The death of those elves and your question. It is to show you how they differ from us, and how you must work to learn their ways. You will spend time among them."
"Is the tale of the dead elf true?"
"Yes. The newly fallen elf was the late elf king, Queen Aglarana's husband. I was but a boy then, 30 years ago, but I remember it. I was with a hunting party when the accident happened, and I met the priest."
Garrett said nothing, and Martin picked up his weapon and resumed his journey. They soon came to the edge of Elvander. Martin stopped while Garrett stood enraptured by the sight of the great trees. The late afternoon sun cast long shadows through the forest, but the high boughs were already glimmering with their own fairy light. Martin took Garrett by the elbow and gently guided the gawking tracker along to the Queen's court. He reached the council ring and entered, saluting the Queen. Aglarana smiled at sight of him.
"Welcome, Martin Longbow. It has been too long since you last came to us."
Martin introduced Garrett, who bowed awkwardly before the Queen. Then another figure entered the court, from where he had stood in the shadows. Martin had grown alongside elven children and was as able as any man in hiding his emotions when need be. But the sight of Thomas rocked him to the point of nearly exclaiming. Biting back a comment, he forced himself not to stare and heard Garrett's indrawn breath of amazement. They had heard of the changes in Thomas, but nothing had prepared either Martin or Garrett for the sight of the towering man before him. Alien eyes regarded them. There was little remaining of the happy, grinning boy who had once followed Martin through the woods, begging for tales of the elves, or played barrel ball with Garrett. Without cordiality, Thomas stepped forward and said,
"What word from Cridy?"
Martin leaned upon his bow.
"Prince Aruthas sends his greetings," he said to the Queen, "and his affections, as well as his hope for your good health."
Turning to Thomas, who had obviously usurped some position of command within the Queen's council, he said,
"Aruthas sends the following news. Blackgi, Duke of Bastyra, now rules in Krondor, so no help will be forthcoming to the far coast. Also, the prince has good cause to believe the Outworlders plan to mount a major offensive soon. Whether against Cridy, Elvander, or the Duke's army, he cannot tell. However, the southern enclaves are not being reinforced through the dwarven mines, though they are strongly dug in. My trackers have had some signs of northward movement, but nothing on a large scale. It is Aruthas' guess the most likely offensive will be against his father and Brukhall's army."
Then he said,
"And I bring word that Aruthas' squire has been slain."
He observed the elven avoidance of naming the dead. Thomas's eyes betrayed a glint of emotion at the news of Roland's death, but all he said was, "In war, men die." Kaelin realized the exchange was something of a personal matter between Longbow and Thomas. No one else in the court had known Roland well, though Kaelin remembered him from the dinner that night so many years ago in Crydee. Martin was troubled by Thomas's reaction to the news of his boyhood friend's death. Returning to the business of the war, the elf prince said,
"It is a logical thing. Should the kingdom army in the west be broken, the outworlders could then turn their full attention on the other fronts, gaining the free cities and Crydee quickly. Within a year, two at the most, all of what once was Keshian Bazania would be under their banners. Then they could march easily upon Yabon. In time, they could march to the gates of Krondor."
Thomas faced Kaelin as if to speak, his eyes narrow. A flash of communication passed between the queen and Thomas, and he stepped back into his place in the council circle. Kaelin continued,
"If the outworlders are not staging to the west of the mountains, then we should be joined by the dwarves soon. We've had sorties across the river from the outworlders, but no sign of major attacks to come. I think Arutha is correct in his surmise, and should the dukes call, we should try to aid them."
Thomas turned upon the elf prince.
"Leave Elvander unprotected?"
His face showed outrage. Martin was startled by the ferocity of Thomas's barely checked anger.
"Without stripping the elven forests of defenders, we could not mount enough numbers to matter in such a battle."
Kaelin's face remained impassive, but his eyes mirrored Thomas's anger. His words came forth quietly.
"I am war leader of Elvander. I would not leave our forests unprotected. But should the outworlders mount a major offensive against the dukes, they will not leave sufficient soldiers along the river to menace our forests. They have not come against us since we defeated them with the sorcerer's aid and their black robes were killed. But should they battle Lords Boric and Brucall, and should the battle be a close thing, our numbers might tip the balance, especially as we can strike against their weaker flank."
Thomas maintained his self-control, standing rigidly for a moment. Then in icy tones he said,
"The dwarves follow Dolgan, and Dolgan follows my lead. They will not come unless I call them to battle."
Without another word, he left the council circle. Martin watched Thomas leave. His skin crawled as he felt for the first time the power contained within this strange blend of man and whatever else lived inside the boy from Crydee. He had caught only a glimpse of what was within Thomas, but it had been enough. Thomas was a being to be feared. Martin then saw a flicker of expression on Aglarana's face. She rose and said,
"I had better have words with Thomas. He has been overwrought of late."
As she left, Martin was struck by a certainty. Whatever else he had seen, he had witnessed a conflict between the elf queen's son and her lover, and a deep conflict within herself as well. Aglarana had worn the expression of one caught in a hopeless fate. When the queen had left, Kaelin said,
"You have come at a propitious time, Martin. We have need of your wisdom."
Martin nodded. He sent Garrett away to get something to eat, and when he was gone, Martin studied the elf prince, then the others in the council. T'Thar stood at his usual place, to the right of the queen's throne. Others he knew, all old and trusted advisers of the queen. Many were ancient spellweavers. Martin sat down, patiently waiting for Kaelin to speak. The elf prince remained silent for a time. Martin studied Kaelin, for he knew him and could sense his disquiet. As a boy, Martin had thought the elf prince the finest embodiment of all elven virtues. While his boyish hero worship had passed, he still regarded Kaelin with undiminished respect. Kaelin said, Martin, of all here, you are the only one to have known Thomas before this change. What can you say of the transformation you've seen?
Martin spent time considering his reply.
I have only glimpsed these changes over the years until this day. That they are great is obvious. But as to what they herald, I cannot begin to guess. He was a good enough boy, one not overly given to mischief, though with enough curiosity to find it. He had a tender side and did not hold back in his affections. His temper was moderate, though he could lose control when a friend was threatened or struck. In all, he was much like other boys, a dreamer.
And now? Martin was troubled and took no pains to hide this.
He is something beyond my understanding.
T'Thar said,
Your words are clear to us, Martin, and true, for he has also gone beyond our understanding.
Kaelin spoke softly. Of men, you know our history more than any. You know of our hatred for the ages spent in bondage to the Valharu. You know we reject the dark path they trod. We fear the return of that power as much as we do this invasion of outworlders and their black robes. You have seen Thomas. You must know what we are forced to consider.
Martin nodded.
Yes, you weigh his life. Many of the younger elves follow him blindly, said T'Thar. They lack the maturity and wisdom to withstand the subtle influence of the Valharu magic within him. And while the dwarves do not follow blindly, still they follow, for they have none of our heritage of fear, and they put great faith in his leadership. He has proved the means of their survival for 8 years now, saving many of them from death repeatedly. But while Thomas has been a boon to us in this struggle against the invaders, we may have to put aside all other considerations save one. Will this half-man, half-Valharu attempt to become our master?
T'Thar frowned.
If so, he must be destroyed.
Martin felt cold inside. Of all the boys he had known at Crydee, he had held special affection for three, Garrett, Thomas, and Pug. He had mourned silently when Pug had been taken by the Surani, and had often wondered if it had been to his death or captivity. Now he mourned for Thomas. For whatever else might occur, Thomas would never again be as he once was. Martin said to Kaelin,
Can nothing be done?
Kaelin indicated T'Thar should answer the question. The old spellweaver looked around the circle, gaining silent agreement from the other spellweavers. To Martin, he said,
We do what we can to bring this to a good ending. But should the Valharu come forth in his might, we would not withstand. So we are fearful. We harbor no hatred for Thomas, but even as you pity a rabid wolf, you must kill it.
Martin looked grimly out at the lights of Elvander as darkness deepened. As long as he remembered, it had been a comforting sight. Now he felt only cold bitterness.
When shall you decide? T'Thar said, You understand our ways. We shall decide when we must decide.
Martin rose slowly to his feet.
My counsel to you then is this. Until the change has clearly shown itself to be toward the dark path, do not mistakenly give too much weight to ancient fears. I have long been taught that those who now rule in Elvander are of heartier nature and more independent mind than those who were first set free by the Valharu. Stay your hand until the last. something good may come of this yet. Or if not that, something that is not entirely ill.
T'Thaa nodded.
Your counsel is given well. It is well received.
Martin looked heavily burdened.
I will do what I can. Once I was able to influence Thomas, perhaps I may yet again. I will go meditate upon the matter, then seek him out and speak with him.
None in the circle around the Queen's court spoke as he left. They knew his heart was as troubled as their own. The throbbing had become worse, not quite a pain, but a discomfort that grew unnervingly more persistent. Thomas sat in the cool glade near the quiet pool, struggling within himself. Since coming to live in Elvander, he had found his dreams little more than vague, shadowy images, with half-remembered phrases and names to grasp. They were less troublesome, less fearful, less a presence in his daily life. But the pressure within his head, the dull near ache, had grown. When he was in battle, he became lost in red rage, and there was no sense of the ache. But when the battle lust subsided, especially when he was slow to return to Elvander, the throbbing returned. Footsteps sounded lightly behind, and without turning, he said,
I wish to be alone.
Aglarana said,
The pain, Thomas?
A faint stirring of some strange feeling rose briefly within, and he cocked his head as if listening for something.
Then he answered curtly, Yes, I will return to our room soon. Leave now and prepare for me to join you later.
Aglarana stepped back, her proud features showing pain at being addressed in such a tone. She turned quickly and left. As she walked through the woods, her emotions churned within. Since surrendering to Thomas's desire and her own, she had lost the ability to command him, or to resist his commands. He was now lord over her, and she felt shame. It was a joyless union, not the return of lost happiness she had hoped for. But there was a will-sapping compulsion, a need to be with him, to belong to him, that stripped away her defenses. Thomas was dynamic, powerful, and sometimes cruel. She corrected herself. Not cruel, just so removed from any other being. No comparison could be made. He was not indifferent to her needs. He simply was unaware she had any. As she approached Elvander, the soft fairy lights reflected in the shimmering tears that touched her cheeks. Thomas was only partially aware of her departure. Under the dull ache within his head, a voice faintly called to him. He strained to listen, knowing its timbre, its colour, knowing who called.
Thomas?
Yes. Ashenshugger looked across the desolation of the plains, dry, cracked lands devoid of moisture, save for bubbling alkali pots that spewed foul odours into the air. Aloud, to his unseen companion, he said,
It has been some time since we last spoke.
T'Thaa and the others seek to keep us apart. You are often forgotten. The fetid winds blew from the north, cold but cloying. The smell of decay was everywhere, and in the residue of the mighty madness that had gripped the universe around, only faint stirrings of life reasserting itself were felt.
No matter. We are together again.
What is this place?
The desolation of the Chaos Wars. Draken Corrin's monument. The lifeless tundra that was once great grasslands. Few living things abide here. Most creatures flee to the south and more hospitable climes.
Who are you? Ashenshugger laughed,
I am what you are becoming. We are one. So you have said many times.
I had forgotten.
Ashensugar called, and Chiruga sped toward him over a grey landscape, while black clouds thundered overhead. The mighty dragon landed, and his master climbed upon his back. Casting a glance at the spot marked by Ash, the only reminder of Draken Corrin's existence, the Valhuru said,
Come, let us see what fate has wrought.
Chiruga leaped into the heavens, and above the desolation they flew. Ashensugar was silent as he rode upon Chiruga's broad back, feeling the wind blowing across his face. They flew, and time passed them by as they shared the death of one age and the birth of another. High in the blue sky they soared, free of the horror of the Chaos Wars.
It is worthy of sorrow.
I think not. There is a lesson, though I cannot bring myself to know it. Yet I sense you do.
Ashensugar closed his eyes as the throbbing returned.
Yes, I remember.
Thomas?
Thomas's eyes snapped open. He found Ghislaine standing a short way off, near the edge of the clearing.
Shall I return later?
Thomas rose slowly from where he had sat dreaming. His voice was rough and tired.
No. What is it?
Dolgan's dwarven band has reached the outer forest and waits for you near the winding brook. The dwarves struck an outworld enclave as they crossed the river.
There was a merry smile upon the young elf's face.
They have finally captured prisoners.
A strange look of mixed delight and fury passed over Thomas's face. Ghislaine felt strange emotions as he regarded the reaction of the warrior in white and gold to this news. As if listening to a distant call, Thomas spoke distractedly.
Go to the dwarven camp. I will join you there presently.
Ghislaine withdrew, and Thomas listened.
A distant voice grew louder. Have I erred?
The hall echoed with the words, for now it was vacant, the servants having slipped away. Ashensugar brooded upon his throne. He spoke to shadows.
Have I erred?
Now you know doubt, answered the ever-present voice.
This strange quietness within, what is it?
It is death approaching.
Ashensugar closed his eyes.
I thought as much. So few of my kind lived beyond battle. It was a rare thing. I am the last. Still, I would like to fly Chiruga once more.
He is gone.
Dead.
Ages past.
But I flew him this morning.
It was a dream. As is this.
Am I then also mad?
You are but a memory. This is but a dream.
Then I will do what is planned. I accept the inevitable. Another will come to take my place.
So it has happened already, for I am the one who came, and I have taken up your sword and put upon your mantle. Your cause is now mine. I stand against those who would plunder this world.
Then am I content to die.
Opening his eyes, he took one last look at his hall now cloaked in ancient dust. Closing them for the last time, the ruler of the Eagle's Reaches cast his final spell. His waning powers, still unmatched upon this world by any save the new gods, flowed from his tired body, infusing his armor. Smoky wisps wafted upward from where his body had rested, and soon only the golden armor, white tabard, shield, and sword of white and gold remained.
I am Ashensugar. I am Thomas.
Thomas's eyes opened, and for a moment he was confused to find himself in the glade. A strange passion grew within as he felt a new strength flowing throughout his being. In his mind rang a clarion call. I am Ashen Sugar, the Valhuru. I will destroy all who seek to plunder my world. With a terrible resolve, he left the glade to find the place the dwarves had brought his enemies.
It is good to see you again, friend Longbow, said Dolgan, puffing away on his pipe.
They had not seen each other since a chance meeting several years before, when the dwarves passed through the forest east of Cridy on their way to Elvander. Martin, Kaelin, and a few elves had come to see the dwarves' prisoners, who were still bound. They waited in a group in a corner of the clearing, glaring at their captors. Galain entered the clearing and said,
Thomas is coming soon.
Martin said,
How is it, Dolgan, after all these years you managed to capture prisoners and an entire enclave at that?
Behind the 8 bound warriors stood a fearful group of Serrani slaves, unbound but huddled together, uncertain of their fate. Dolgan gave an off-handed wave.
Usually we're raiding across the river, and prisoners tend to slow things down during a withdrawal, being either unconscious or uncooperative. This time we had little choice in the matter, as we needed to cross the River Cridy. In past years we'd wait to sneak across in darkness, but this year they're as close as nettles in a thicket everywhere along the river. We found this band in a relatively isolated spot, with only these 8 to guard the slaves. They were repairing an earthwork, one that I judge was overrun a short while ago during an elven sortie. We slipped around them, then a few of the lads climbed into the trees, though they liked it little. We dropped down upon the 3 outer guards, silencing them before they could shout the alert. The other 5 were napping, the lazy louts. We slipped into camp, and after a few well-placed strokes with our hammers, we bound them. These others, he indicated the slaves, were too timid to make a sound. When it was clear we had not alarmed the nearby enclaves, we thought to bring them along. Seemed a waste to leave them behind. Thought we might learn something useful.
Dolgan tried to keep an impassive expression, but pride over his company's work shone through like a beacon in the night. Martin smiled his approval and said to Kaelin,
I hope we may learn what is coming, if the feared offensive is really to be mounted, and where. I've learned a few phrases of their tongue, but not enough to make any sense of what they might tell us. Only Father Tully and Charles, my Serrani tracker, can speak to them fluently. Perhaps we should attempt to move them to Cridy?
Kaelin said, We have the means to learn their tongue, given time. I doubt they would lend much cooperation in their transport. Most likely they would try to raise the alarm every step of the way.
Martin conceded the point. Then a disturbance caused him to turn.
Thomas came striding into the clearing. Dolgan began to greet him, but something in the young warrior's manner and expression silenced him. There was madness in Thomas's eyes, something the dwarf had glimpsed before as a glimmer, but which now shone forth brightly. Thomas regarded the bound prisoners, then pulled his sword slowly and pointed at them. The words he spoke were alien to both Martin and the dwarves, but the elves were rocked by what they heard. Several of the older elves dropped to their knees in supplication, and the younger ones drew away in reflexive fear. Only Kaelin stood his ground, though he appeared shaken. Then slowly the elf prince turned to Martin, his face drained of color. In terrified tones he said,
At last, the Valhuru is truly among us.
Ignoring all others in the clearing, Thomas walked up to the first Serrani prisoner. The bound soldier looked up with a mixture of fear and defiance. Suddenly, the golden sword was raised high and arced down, severing the man's head from his shoulders. Blood splattered the white tabard, then flowed off, leaving it spotless. A low moan of fear came from the huddled slaves, and the remaining soldiers' eyes were wide in terror. Slowly Thomas turned to face the next prisoner, and again his sword took a life. Martin freed himself from shocked paralysis, forcing his eyes away from the butchery. He felt terrible dread, but it appeared as nothing to what the elves revealed in their abasement before Thomas. Kaelin's face showed a struggle within as he tried to overcome a nearly instinctive obedience to the words spoken in the ancient language of the Valharu, masters of all, ages past. The younger elves, less studied in the old wisdom, simply had no understanding of the overwhelming need to obey this man in white and gold. The language of the Valharu was still the language of power. Thomas turned away from his slaughter, and Martin felt struck by the strength of his gaze. Gone was any vestige of the boy from Crydee. Now an alien presence suffused his being. Thomas's arm drew back, and Martin tensed to dodge the blow. Any human was a potential victim, and even the dwarves drew back at the awesome menace Thomas projected. Then a faint spark of recognition entered Thomas's eyes, and he said, in a distant voice, "Martin, by the love I once bore you, be gone, or your life is forfeit." Mustering courage against the most consuming fear he had ever felt, Martin shouted, "I'll not stand and watch you slaughter helpless men!" Again a distant voice answered, steeped in ancient majesty and lost grandeur regained. "These come into my world, Martin. None may seek that which is my domain, my preserve, mine alone. Shall you, too, come into my world, Martin?" With inhuman speed, Thomas wheeled, and Tusarani died. Martin charged, crossing the gap between them in a bound, and knocked Thomas away from the prisoners. They went down in a heap, and Martin grabbed at the wrist that held the golden sword. A strong man capable of carrying a freshly killed buck for miles, Martin was no match for Thomas. As easily as picking up a bothersome infant, Thomas pushed Martin aside and came lightly to his feet. Martin sprang at Thomas again, but this time Thomas stood ready. He simply seized Martin by the tunic and said, "None may interfere with my will." He tossed Martin across the clearing as if he weighed less than a tenth his weight. Martin's arms flailed the air as he arced high over the ground, striving to control his fall. He landed hard, and all around could hear the breath explode from his lungs as he struck. Dolgan rushed to his side, for the elves were still held in thrall by what they had witnessed. The dwarven chief poured water from a skin at his side upon Martin's face and shook him awake. The strangled cries of terror from the Surani slaves watching soldiers being butchered greeted Martin as he regained his wits. Martin struggled to focus his vision, the scene before him swimming and shifting. When he could see, he drew a hissing breath in horror. Thomas struck down the last Surani soldier and began to advance upon the cringing slaves. They appeared unable to move, watching with wide eyes the bringer of their destruction, looking like nothing so much to Martin as a band of deer startled by a sudden light in the night. A ragged cry came from Martin's lips as Thomas killed the first Surani slave, a pitiful-looking willow of a man. Longbow struggled to rise, senses reeling, and Dolgan helped him to his feet. Thomas raised his sword and another died. Again the golden blade was raised, and he looked into the face of his victim. Eyes round with fear, a young boy, no more than 12 years old, stood waiting for the blow that would end his life. Suddenly, time expanded for Thomas, the moment frozen in his mind. He studied the shock of dark hair and the large brown eyes of the boy. The child crouched, awaiting the death he saw over him, his head shaking no, as his lips formed a single phrase, over and over. In the faint light of the clearing, Thomas saw an old ghost, the spectre of a friend long forgotten. A remembered bond from his earliest memories as a child reassociated itself with his consciousness. Images blurred, past and present confused, and he said, "Pug?" Within his mind, pain exploded, and another will sought to overwhelm him. "Pug!" it shrieked. "Kill him!" came a raging answer, and within him two wills battled. "No!" screamed the other. To everyone in the glade, Thomas stood frozen, shaking with some inner struggle, his sword still held high, waiting for release.
"These are the enemy. Slay them."
"He is a boy, only a boy."
"He is the enemy. A boy."
Thomas's face became a mask of pain. His teeth clenched, and every muscle drew taut, stretching skin tightly over skull. His eyes grew round, and perspiration began to flow from under his helm, down his brows and cheeks. Martin stumbled to his feet. He moved slowly, every gesture bringing pain from the battering he had taken. Thomas's hands slowly moved downward, each inch a shaking, trembling passage as he warred within. The boy was transfixed, unable to move, his eyes following the movement of the blade.
"I am Ashen Sugar. I am Valharu," sang a voice within, in a torrent of anger, battle madness, and bloodlust.
Against this sea of rage stood a single rock, a calm, small voice within that said simply, "I am Thomas." Again and again the sea of hate crashed over the rock of calm, each time engulfing it, then sliding back to come again. But each time the tide diminished and the rock stood clear, rising above the mad surf. A shattering of something, the thundering of ages lost and passing, rocked Thomas's mind. He reeled, then swam within an alien landscape, seeking a pinpoint of light he knew was his way to freedom. Tide swept him along, and he battled, struggling to keep his head above the strangling black sea. A shrieking, evil wind blew overhead, and to his ears it sang a song of woeful meter. He struck out, and again he saw a pinpoint of light. Again the tide engulfed him, forcing him away from his goal, but this time it was weaker. Once more he struggled toward the light. Then came a surge, a last terrifying assault culminating in a total attack upon him.
"I am Ashen Sugar."
There came a breaking of the will, something snapping like the dead branch of a tree under the weight of newly fallen snow, like the sound of old winter ice breaking at spring's touch, as if the last assault took too great a toll. The Black Sea lost its fury and subsided, and he was again standing upon firm ground, a single rock.
"I am Thomas."
In the distance, the pinpoint of light began to expand before his eyes, racing forward to engulf him.
"I am Thomas."
"Thomas!"
He blinked and saw he was again in the glade. Before him crouched the boy, waiting to die. He turned his head and saw Martin sighting along a cloth-yard arrow, drawn hard against his cheek. The huntmaster of Crydee said,
Put down your sword, or by the gods I'll kill you where you stand.
Thomas's gaze wandered about the glade, and he saw the dwarves with weapons drawn, as had some of the older elves. Cailin, still shaking, had his sword out and was slowly advancing upon him. Martin watched Thomas closely, not fearing him, but respectful of his awesome strength and speed. He waited and saw the flicker of madness still in Thomas's eyes, then, as if a veil were lifted, saw them clear. Abruptly, the golden sword fell from his hand, and the pale, nearly colourless eyes filled with tears. Thomas dropped to his knees, and a moan of terrible anguish was torn from his lips, and Thomas cried out, "Oh, Martin, what have I become?" Martin lowered his bow, watching as Thomas gathered his arms about himself. Into the glade came T'Thar and the other spell weavers. They approached Thomas and then surveyed the others in the glade. So terrible were Thomas's sobs of anguish, so filled with sorrow and remorse, that many of the elves discovered they also wept. T'Thar said to Martin Longbow, "We felt the fabric of our spells torn asunder a short while ago, and came at once. We feared the Valhuru had come, rightly it seems." Martin said, "Now?" "The other side of the balance. That the Valhuru is at last displaced by the boy, there can be no doubt. But the boy now must feel the weight of ages of slaughter, and the guilt over joy felt when taking other lives. The burdens felt by mortals are again his, and we shall now see if he can withstand them. This agony may prove his end." Martin left the ancient elf and crossed to Thomas. In the dim light, he was the first to perceive the change. Gone were the alien cast to his features, the gleaming eyes, the haughty brow. Again he was Thomas, a man, though there were still legacies of his experience that would forever proclaim him something more than a man. The elven ears, the pale eyes. Gone was the Lord of Power, the Old One, the Valhuru. Where before a dragon lord had stood, now crouched a troubled, sick man in torment over what he had done. Thomas raised his head as Martin touched him upon the shoulder. Red-rimmed eyes, nearly mad from grief, regarded Martin for a brief moment, then closed as if seeking oblivion to all around. For some time the elves and dwarves watched, and the Serrani slaves were silent, aware that some miracle had occurred, not understanding, but suddenly sure they were spared. For some time they watched, as Martin Longbow cradled the sobbing man in white and gold, who cried in anguish so terrible to hear. Aglarana sat upon her sleeping pallet, brushing her long red gold hair. As before, she waited for Thomas, half hoping, half fearing he would come. A shout from outside caused her to rise. She gathered her robes around her and left her quarters. Standing upon a platform, she watched as a group of elves and dwarves came toward Elvander's heart. With them came Martin Longbow and some humans, clearly outworlders from their dress. Her hands went to her mouth as she gasped. In the center of the group walked Thomas, at his side a young boy with eyes wide at the splendor of Elvander. Aglarana was unable to move, fearful that what she witnessed was the product of delusion born of hope. Time sped past as she waited. Then Thomas stood before her. Leaving the boy, he stepped forward. Martin took the boy by the hand and led him away, the others following, giving the elf queen and Thomas the solitude they needed. Thomas reached out slowly and touched her face, and he drank in the sight of her, as if seeing her as he had first at Crydee. Then, without words, He slowly, gently enfolded her in his arms. He held her in silence, letting her feel the warmth of the love that filled him at sight of her. After a time, he whispered in her ear, "For each moment of sorrow I have visited upon you, O my lady, I pray the gods grant me a year to gift you with joy. I am again your adoring subject." Too filled with happiness to speak, the elf queen simply clung to him, her sorrow only a dim memory. Chapter 10. Emissary. The troops stood quietly. Long columns of men awaited their turn at passing through the rift into Midkemia. Officers walked by, their presence ensuring discipline in the lines. Lorry, in the mask and robe of a red priest, was impressed at the level of control these officers had over their men. He judged the Serrani code of honor, where orders were followed without question, a very alien thing. He and Kasumi moved quickly down the line, heading for the first detachment behind the one now entering the rift. Lorry bent his knees and stooped, to detract from his noticeable height. As they had hoped, more soldiers than not looked away as the bogus red priest passed. When they reached the head of the column, Kasumi fell in. His younger brother, who had been promoted to strike leader for this offensive, seemed to pay no attention to his commander's late arrival, or to the priest of Turukamu who arrived with him. After a seemingly interminable delay, the command came, and they stepped forward into the shimmering glow of nothingness that marked the rift between the two worlds. There was a brief flash of lights, a momentary dizziness, and they found themselves walking forward into a light Midkemian rain. Sheets of wetness, little more than a heavy mist, fell around them. The Serrani soldiers, hot weather bred, wrapped cloaks about themselves. A staging officer briefly conferred with Kasumi, and the troops were ordered to move off to the northeast a specified distance and erect a camp. Kasumi and Hokonu were then to report to the warlord's tent for briefings. The warlord himself was back in Kentosani, the holy city, preparing for the imperial games, but his sub-commander was to instruct them in their duties and areas of responsibility until his return. They quickly moved up toward the front and set up camp. Once the commander's tent was up, Lorry and the Shinzawe brothers ducked inside. While bundles containing Midkemian clothing and weapons were unpacked, Kasumi said, "As soon as we return from our meeting with the sub-commander, we will eat. Tonight we will lead a patrol of our area and try to slip through the lines." Kasumi looked at his brother. "After we have gone, brother, it will be your responsibility to hide our departure for as long as possible. Once there has been fighting reported, you may claim we have been lost to the enemy." Hokonu agreed. "We had best report now." Kasumi looked at Lorry. "Stay inside. We want no risk. You are the tallest damn priest I have ever seen." Lorry nodded. He sat upon some cushions and waited. The patrol moved silently through the trees. The rain had stopped, but the weather had turned colder, and Lorry suppressed a shiver. Years in the hot climes of Kellywan had driven away his ability to ignore the chill. He wondered about the new troops from Suranawani and how they would react when the first snowfalls came. Most likely with studied indifference, regardless of what they felt inside. A Serrani soldier would never let himself appear upset by something as trivial as solid water falling from the sky. They elected the North Pass, for it led to the largest front, and they were less likely to be noticed passing through the lines. They reached the head of the pass, and a station guard passed them along. Once outside the valley, they struck slightly more eastward than their patrol called for. Beyond the rolling hills and light woods was the road from Lamut to Zoon. Once the two travellers had left their patrol and reached the road, they would head for Zoon by horses and ride south. With luck, they would reach Krondor in 2 weeks. There they would change mounts and head for Salador, where they would find passage on a ship for Rillanon. The only obstacle between them and the road was a large portion of the kingdom's army. If they were discovered by a kingdom patrol, they would try to pass themselves off as travellers who had been captured by the Serrani and escaped. There could be no question of Lorry being Serrani, and Kasumi's command of the king's tongue was so complete that he could easily pass for a kingdom citizen from the Vale of Dreams. Several languages were spoken in that border area with Great Kesh, so Kasumi's slight accent would be reasonable. The patrol moved at a dog trot that ate up miles. Lorry ran beside Kasumi, marveling at the soldier's stamina. They might not be showing fatigue, but he was feeling it. Hokanu signaled for the patrol to stop at the head of a large flat area near the woods. Here we will start our swing back to our patrol area. We should not see any Serrani soldiers from here. Let us hope, for your sake, we don't meet with kingdom troops either. He gave a signal, and they moved out. Lorry and Kasumi were handed backpacks and clothing. They quickly changed, then followed the route taken by the patrol. They would follow for a short distance, using the patrol for cover, should any kingdom troops be nearby. They moved into a small vale and found the patrol held up by something ahead. The last man in line motioned them for quiet. They moved to the head of the line, and Lorry looked around for a quick exit route, should there be any trouble. Hokanu said softly, "I thought I heard something, but there has been no sound for several minutes." Kasumi nodded. "Then move forward. We will wait until you have crossed that open area ahead, then follow to the woods." He indicated a stand of trees on the other side of the clearing. When the patrol had reached the center of the open area, the clouds parted and shafts of moonlight lit up the area. "Damn!" Kasumi swore under his breath. "They might as well light torches now." Suddenly the trees erupted with motion and sound. The ground trembled as riders came charging forward, out from the trees that hid them. Each wore heavy chainmail and a full helm. Long lances were leveled at the surprised Serrani soldiers. The Serrani had barely enough time to ready a rude line for defense before the riders were upon them. Cries of horses and men filled the air, and the Serrani fell before the charge. The riders rode over the Serrani and reformed at the end of the vale where the two fugitives hid. They wheeled about and charged again. The Serrani survivors of the last charge, less than half the men, moved quickly up the west side of the vale, where the trees and incline of the hillside would counter the horsemen's ability to charge. Lorry touched Kasumi's arm and motioned to the right. It was evident the Serrani officer was barely holding himself in check from joining his men. Suddenly Kasumi was off, hugging the edge of the trees as he ran low. Lorry followed and spotted what appeared to be a rough path heading eastward. He grabbed Kasumi's sleeve and pointed. They turned their backs to the fighting and moved off. The next day found two travellers moving down the road to Zoon. Both wore woolen shirts, trousers, and cloaks. Closer examination by a trained eye would have revealed that the material was not really wool, but something like it. Their belts and boots were made from Nidra hide, dyed to resemble leather. The fashion was Midkemian, as were the swords they wore on their belts. One was obviously a minstrel, for he wore a lute slung over his backpack. The other looked to be a freebooter mercenary. Any casual observer would have been unlikely to guess their origins, or the riches carried in those backpacks. for each had a small fortune in gems tucked away in the bottom of his pack. A northbound troop of light cavalry passed them on the road, and Lorry said, "Things have changed since I was last here. Those men in the forest were Royal Crondorian lancers, and those who just passed wore the colours of Questor's View. All the forces of the armies of the West must be marshalling here. Something seems to be in the air. Perhaps they have somehow gleaned your warlord's plan for a major offensive."
"I don't know. Whatever is happening does not seem to indicate that things are as stable as we have been led to believe back home. Alliances are very uneasy. Since the death of the Lord of the Min Wanabi and the emergence of new forces in the Great Game, the warlord may be more desperate than my father judged. And the concentration of troops here makes me think the warlord's victory may not be easily won." Kasumi was quiet for a moment as they walked along the road. "I hope that Hokonu was among those who reached the trees." It was the first time he had mentioned his brother, and Lorry could think of nothing to say.
2 days later, Lorry, a minstrel late of Tir Sarg, and Kenneth, a mercenary from the Vale of Dreams, sat in the Green Cat Inn in the city of Zoon. Both ate with hearty appetite, for they had lived on soldiers' rations, cakes of grain and dried fruit, for 2 days. Lorry had spent over an hour negotiating with a less than reputable gem broker for several smaller stones' value. He had settled for 1/3 their actual worth, stating, "If he thinks they are stolen, he will not be too quick to ask questions." Kasumi asked, "Why didn't you sell him all the stones?" "Your father has given us enough to retire on for the rest of our days. I doubt if all the brokers in Zoon could raise the gold to pay for them. We will sell a few as we travel. Besides, they weigh less than gold." Finishing their meal, the two men paid and left. Kasumi could only just refrain from staring at all the metal he could see everywhere. A lifetime's riches on Kelewon. Just the cost of the meal in silver could support a Surani family for a year. They hurried along one of the city's business streets, heading to the south gate. Near there, they had been informed, a reputable trader in horses would sell them mounts and tack for a fair price. They found the man, a thin, hawk-beaked fellow by the name of Bryn. Lorry spent the better part of an hour haggling with the horse trader for 2 of his better mounts. They left him, expressing concern over their ability to sleep nights after cheating an honest businessman out of the money he needed to feed his starving children. As they rode through the gate that put them on the road to Yelith, Kasumi said, "Much of this land of yours seems odd. But as you haggled with that merchant, I was reminded of home. Our traders are much more polite and would never think of raising their voices in such a manner. But it is still the same thing. They all have starving children." Lorry laughed and spurred his mount forward. Soon they were out of sight of the city. South of Questor's View, they passed more troops on the road. This time kingdom regulars and auxiliaries trudging along on foot while their officers rode. Lorry and Kasumi had stopped to untack and graze their horses while the column moved past. The fighter watched the soldiers passing with an expert's eye. Red uniformed soldiers marched in tight formation, while the more ragged auxiliaries still managed a look of organization. The baggage train moved in good order, experienced cart drivers keeping the animals in proper intervals. When they passed, Kasumi said, "Those soldiers are better than any I've seen so far on your world, Lorry. Those in red look like professionals. They march well. And those others seem experienced, despite their motley look." Lorry nodded. "I recognize the standard. That's the garrison of Shamata in the Vale of Dreams. They have had their fair share of fighting Kesh's dog soldiers and are a veteran outfit. Those others are auxiliaries, Veilman mercenaries, a less tender band of lads you'd be hard-pressed to find. Lorry started to resaddle his horse. They're as seasoned a force of men as your countrymen will have faced, in truth. When the horses were tacked up, Lorry and Kasumi remounted and rode on. Soon they could see the bitter sea as the road rounded the hills of Questa's view. Lorry pulled up his horse and stared out to sea.
"What is it?" asked Kasumi.
Lorry shaded his eyes.
"Ships! A whole fleet of them sailing north."
He sat for a moment watching, and at last Kasumi could see dots of white upon the blue of the sea.
"Where are they bound?" Kasumi asked.
"Yalith is the only major point north of here. They must be carrying supplies for the war."
They resumed their ride. A sense of urgency descended upon them both, as everything they saw pointed to an intensification of the war, and the longer they tarried, the less likely the success of their mission.